1 Kings 21. Sometime later, there was an incident involving a vineyard belonging to Naboth the Jezreelite. The vineyard was in Jezreel, close to the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria. Ahab said to Naboth, "Let me have your vineyard to use for a vegetable garden, since it's close to my palace. In exchange, I will give you a better vineyard, or if you prefer, I will pay you whatever it's worth." But Naboth replied, "The Lord forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my ancestors." So Ahab went home, sullen and angry, because Naboth the Jezreelite had said, "I will not give you the inheritance of my ancestors." He lay on his bed, sulking, and refused to eat. His wife Jezebel came in and asked him, "Why are you so sullen? Why won't you eat?" He answered her, "Because I said to Naboth the Jezreelite, 'Sell me your vineyard, or if you prefer, I'll give you another vineyard in its place.' But he said, 'I will not give you my vineyard.'" Jezebel, his wife, said, "Is this how you act as king of Israel? Get up and eat. Cheer up. I'll get you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite." So she wrote letters in Ahab's name, placed his seal on them, and sent them to the elders and nobles who lived in Naboth's city with him. In those letters, she wrote, "Proclaim a day of fasting and seat Naboth in a prominent place among the people. But seat two scoundrels opposite him and have them bring charges that he has cursed both God and king. Then take him out and stone him to death." So the elders and nobles who lived in Naboth's city did as Jezebel directed in the letters she had written to them. They proclaimed a fast and seated Naboth in a prominent place among the people. Then two scoundrels came and sat opposite him and brought charges against Naboth before the people, saying, "Naboth has cursed both God and the king." So they took him outside the city and stoned him to death. Then they sent word to Jezebel, "Naboth has been stoned to death." As soon as Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned to death, she said to Ahab, "Get up and take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite that he refused to sell you. He is no longer alive, but dead." When Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, he got up and went down to take possession of Naboth's vineyard. This is the word of the Lord. On July 10, 1973, John Paul Getty III was kidnapped in the early morning hours near the Piazza Farnese in Rome. The kidnappers sent a ransom note to his family demanding $17 million in return for his safety. And they had good reason to believe that that amount of money would be paid, because their kidnapped victim's grandfather was John Paul Getty, the oil tycoon, who, at the time of the kidnapping, was one of the richest men in the world, worth about $5 billion. But John Paul Getty refused to pay the ransom, despite the pleas of the boy's parents. On October 21, months later, a newspaper received an envelope with a lock of hair, a human ear, and a threat that the kidnappers would further harm the boy if the ransom was not paid. Still, the grandfather refused. Finally, desperate to get at least something, the kidnappers reduced the ransom to $3.2 million, and John Paul Getty agreed to pay to a point. He would pay the $2.2 million that his accountant said was tax deductible as a casualty loss. His son, the boy's father, would have to cover the rest, which he did by borrowing the money from his father at 4% interest. John Paul Getty III was freed on December 15. And according to John Pearson's book detailing this family drama, his mother suggested that it might be tactful for the boy to call his grandfather and thank him. When he did call his grandfather refused to come to the phone. But later, in a better mood, he invited the boy and his mother to stay at his English estate because, says Pearson, money is a great healer. Of course, money was not a great healer for the Getty family. One of John Paul Getty's sons died by suicide. Another lost half his life to addiction. John Paul Getty III, the kidnap victim, died at the age of 54 after living as a quadriplegic following an addiction-induced stroke. For the Getty dynasty, money was the cause of destruction and despair. The story of the kidnapping shows just how toxic the family's fortune was, with the life of the grandson determined to be worth, in the end, only as much money as was tax deductible. We get a kind of guilty pleasure from hearing stories like this. For those of us who don't have $5 billion, we take a kind of savage delight in discovering how such money destroys people. It affirms, on the one hand, that money can't in fact buy happiness, and so it helps us to be more content with our lot in life. But it also, I think, lets us imagine that if we were in their shoes, if we had that amount of money, we certainly would not make the choices that they made. We would handle our money better. We would not let money cause us to harm our relationships with other people. That's just a danger for the fabulously wealthy. Like King Ahab. Not just a man with money, but a man with power. Ahab was king of Israel from about 874 to 853 BCE. And while he himself seems to be rather an ineffectual man, his wife most certainly was not. Jezebel was the daughter of King Ethbaal of Sidon, and she had definite ideas about what power and money ought to get a person. So when Ahab throws himself a temper tantrum because he doesn't get a vineyard that he wants, Jezebel rolls her eyes and gets to work. Ahab had tried to buy the vineyard from Naboth to turn into a vegetable garden. I assume Ahab had other vegetable gardens. We don't know why he wanted this one so much. But he zeroes in on this and decides he has to have it. And to Ahab's credit, he makes Naboth an offer to sell or exchange the vineyard. Except that Naboth can't sell the vineyard. When the Israelites entered the promised land, God gave plots of land to each clan and then family, and they were to keep that land in their family forever. The laws of Jubilee stated that every 50 years, any land that had been leased out was to be returned to the original owners. Embedded in Israelite law is both a sense of land as a sacred trust, a gift from God to be stewarded by the people, and a desire to ensure that every Israelite had a place to call home and a source of income. And Ahab, as king of Israel, ought to know this. And maybe he does, but it doesn't matter to him. He wants the vineyard, so he asks Naboth to sell it to him. And when Naboth refuses, Ahab throws a hissy fit. He throws himself down on his bed and he sulks. It's all a little bit pathetic. Which is exactly what his wife Jezebel thinks. Are you a king, she demands, or a bowl of Cheerios? And so Jezebel charts out their course of action. She orchestrates a religious ceremony with Naboth seated where everyone can see him. Opposite him, she puts two men who will do anything for a nickel and has them accuse Naboth of cursing both God and king, a crime punishable by death. Sure enough, an uproar ensues, and Naboth is taken outside the city and stoned to death. We don't know if Jezebel tells Ahab what she did or if she simply says that Ahab died of natural causes. But with Naboth out of the way, a triumphant Ahab takes possession of the vineyard where he can plant tomatoes to his heart's content. The story shows us two ways in which greed can play itself out. First, we see the difference in how Ahab and Naboth relate to the land. For Naboth, land is a sacred trust. It's a gift from God to be stewarded and honored. But for Ahab, land is a commodity. The person who owns land can do with it whatever they want. The land exists for people, not the other way around. And second, greed causes Ahab and Jezebel to treat Naboth as disposable. Naboth stops being a subject whom Ahab is meant to be caring for and protecting, and instead becomes an object, something in the way of what he wants. And the only way to get what he wants is therefore to get rid of the thing standing in his way. Now again, I think we read a story like this and we think to ourselves, well, I would never let money corrupt me like that. I would never treat people as though they are disposable. I would never need something so badly that I would kill someone over it. And I think we wouldn't. I hope we wouldn't. I would like to believe that greed would not lead us to make such a stark decision. But I think the problem that we face is that greed is so baked into our society that we contribute to the objectification and harm of other people without even realizing it. We live in a culture that's built on greed. In order for the economy to grow, we need to buy more, which means that we have to be told that we need more, that we never have enough. Everywhere we look, people are trying to sell us things, and a lot of the time they succeed. And they aren't just selling us things, but selling us a way of life. A life that prizes autonomy and convenience. Both how we spend our money and what we spend our money on indicate that we are living in an increasingly individualistic society where we can be free of any entanglements, any responsibility, any need of other people. We want things without having to give anything of ourselves in return. I'm as guilty of this as the next person, and sometimes it plays itself out in kind of innocuous ways, right? Like, I'll self-scan at the grocery store so I don't have to make small talk with the cashier. I will Google something instead of ask a Lowe's employee for help. I will pay more to have food delivered and left at my front door so I don't have to give my order to an actual human being. Andy Crouch says that the power of money is that it allows us to get things done, often by means of other persons, without the entanglements of friendship. In other words, money allows us to make people into objects. They become means to an end, rather than people with whom we have genuine connections. And look, maybe you don't consider talking to a Lowe's employee about hardwood building a genuine connection. But I do think that all of this is changing how we relate to people, including our friends. Elizabeth Oldfield looks back fondly over her college years, where every few months it seemed that one of her friends was moving. And so everyone would get together and help with the move, and they would build memories through those experiences together. Now, she says, all of my friends have enough money to hire movers. So that's what we do. And there's something lost when you no longer need to ask your community for help. So our spending habits, geared as they are towards autonomy and convenience, are changing our relationships with people, friends and store employees alike. Our desire to acquire things quickly and easily have moved us away from interacting with people as people. Maybe more troublingly, our desire to acquire things cheaply means we are participating in systems of harm and injustice. Shein is the world's most popular brand of fashion and clothing around the world. It's based out of China, and they sell low-priced clothing across the world, marketed by social media influencers who show off their Shein hauls on TikTok and Instagram. The company is wildly successful. The company is also built off of the backs of laborers who work in terrible conditions. Investigations have discovered that some employees work 75-hour shifts with only a few hours of break for sleep. They're working out of informal factories that have been set up against code in residential buildings, laboring in rooms with no windows or emergency exits. There are no contracts or minimum wage requirements. In one factory, employees were working a 17-hour day for a daily base pay of $20, which would be docked by $14 if any garments they made had mistakes. In our global culture of fast fashion, it's easy to not consider the employee halfway around the world who makes the clothing we wear. To buy sustainably and ethically usually means spending more money on fewer items. And we have been trained to want more and more and more. So in our quest for more, people become objects, unnamed and faceless, who we try not to consider as we seek to sate our desires. Now, in case you're not feeling bad enough, let's throw lust into the mix. I've combined lust and greed because they both do essentially the same thing. They cause us to treat people as objects, not subjects. Lust is different from just regular sexual desire, right? Attraction and desire are good things when they are part of a mutual, vulnerable, self-giving relationship. But lust, on the other hand, involves reducing a person to an object, just a tool that can be used for another person's sexual gratification. Love, and a sexuality that is shaped by love, is about mutual self-giving. It involves sacrifice and vulnerability and care and dignity. Lust is the opposite. Lust demands. Lust is self-centered. It strips someone of their personhood. Like greed, lust plays into this idea of autonomy and convenience. With just the click of a button, we can satisfy our desires without having to give anything of ourselves in relationship with another person. Through pornography, particularly, we use the bodies of people that we don't know to make ourselves feel good. And because porn triggers a release of dopamine, the neurotransmitter that makes us feel pleasure, the regular consumption of porn causes our brain to become desensitized to the regular amount of dopamine released during regular sexual activity, which means that we aren't going to receive the same amount of pleasure when we're just having sex with a partner. And so the very thing that should increase our sense of intimacy and vulnerability with a person we love becomes a roadblock in our relationship. So what's lost all the way around is relationship. And relationship is ultimately what we are craving. Frederick Buechner said that lust is the craving for salt by a man dying of thirst. Lust is the craving for salt by a man dying of thirst. I think we can apply that to greed too. We long for connection. We long to be known. We long to live in relationship with God and each other. But we settle for less than that. We try to fill that longing with stuff and with pleasure, with everything that we can achieve and get for ourselves without having to risk any pain or discomfort or vulnerability, which is what relationship asks of us. But the desire is never sated. The salt cannot quench our thirst. So how do we quench the thirst? How do we orient ourselves back towards relationship and develop new habits that affirm people's selfhood and dignity? Well, on the one hand, we can avoid things, right? We can avoid using porn. We can avoid shopping at places that maybe take advantage of their workers. But we can also take on practices, practices like gratitude and generosity. Oldfield says that gratitude is unavoidably relational, implying that we have received help or a gift. It acknowledges need, and need equals vulnerability. Gratitude can be practiced in a number of ways, right? We can be grateful on our own. We can keep like a gratitude journal or make lists at the end of the day of all of the things that we are grateful for. Practicing gratitude reminds us that we do actually have enough, that we don't need more and more and more. Gratitude leads to a place of contentment. But what's maybe more compelling in this case is the practice of extending gratitude to other people. I wonder what it would look like if, as a Lenten discipline, we tried for 1 week to only buy things if we could say thank you to a real person as part of that exchange. If we inconvenienced ourselves, so we actually had to relate to the people around us. And if we then didn't purchase anything where we couldn't trace it back to a real person to whom we could say thank you, how might that practice make us both aware of our spending habits and start to orient us back into relationship, away from the idea of the autonomous self? And we can practice generosity, which is the flip side of gratitude. Being generous with our time or our energy or our things keeps us from calcifying. It chips away at the armor that we use to protect ourselves from any vulnerabilities. Generosity means that we are walking around not with clenched fists, but with open hands, ready to give of ourselves, ready to be in relationship with other people. Gratitude and generosity help keep people in front of us as people, subjects, not objects. People to relate to, not to use. When we think about our money and our resources and our sexuality in terms of what will draw us into actual relationship with other people, we'll find ourselves more fulfilled and satisfied than any company could ever possibly promise us. One commentator I read this week wondered what would have happened had Ahab practiced gratitude and generosity. What might have been had Ahab looked at Naboth as a person with dignity and worth, who could have helped Ahab instead of just being an object in his way? What would have happened if Ahab had simply asked Naboth to grow him some vegetables in his vineyard? Would they have bonded over a shared love of produce? Would they have gotten to know each other over time? Would Naboth have been able to maybe share some wisdom with Ahab as they chatted over the garden wall? Would they have formed a mutually life-giving relationship? We will never know. Ahab let greed get the better of him. But that, I think, is the question for each of us. What life is possible if we live with generosity and gratitude? What flourishing might we find? Would you pray with me? God, help us to live in gratitude and generosity. Remind us that there is so much more life to be had in relationship with you and each other, rather than in relationship with things. Turn us outward. Open us up from our caved-in selves, that we might be able to give and receive with humility and graciousness. And help us to treat each other, our neighbor across the street, and the person a world away, with dignity, relating to one another not as objects to serve a purpose, but as fellow image bearers that you have called us to love. We pray this in the name of Jesus, who gave himself for us. Amen.